ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We're in the mountains in Europe, where there are forests and meadows, and a 27-kilometre tunnel that scientists shoot lasers in. It's CERN, and it costs billions to build, and it's just about to be brought to a halt by a bird with a baguette. I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and in my new series for What the Duck, I'm taking on nature's most wanted, the animals that end up on the wrong side of the law. Find What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Daniel Defoe was a man of secrets. He tried to hide the fact that he was the author of Robinson Crusoe. He was soon exposed and soon famous. What he did manage to hide was his role as a spy in Scotland, infiltrating and sabotaging those who opposed the 1707 union with England. The other life of Daniel Defoe later. But first, stumping up $250 million to buy the Washington Post was the easy part for Jeff Bezos. Dead easy. The founder of Amazon had money to burn. Harder was reviving that ailing paper, finding fresh purpose and new blood. He did it well. One of the new talents hired in 2018 was Sebastian Smee, the Australian Pulitzer Prize-winning critic, then working at the Boston Globe. The hard part for Bezos, and he was not the first newspaper proprietor to discover this, was standing back when his paper began attacking his friends and those he needed to keep on side for his wider business interests. Bezos has now reined in the Post. Sweeping staff cuts in February saw 30% of the newsroom out the door. One of those who lost his job was Sebastian Smee, who's written about the fate of the Washington Post in the latest issue of The Monthly. Sebastian joins us from Boston to talk newspapers, Trump, and the arts in America now.
Great to be talking with you.
That move from Boston to the Washington Post must have seemed as if you were joining a golden age of possibilities on newspapers.
Certainly, yeah. When I joined the Post in 2018, it was really thriving and, you know, kind of neck and neck with the New York Times in terms of readership, breaking so many stories, and under great leadership from Marty Baron, who had been the chief editor at the Boston Globe. He was the guy responsible for breaking those amazing stories about sex child abuse in the Catholic Church. Those stories were the subject of that Oscar-winning film Spotlight. But then, yeah, he moved to the Post and continued his great leadership there. So I was very proud to work for him at both papers.
What was your beat?
Well, my beat was art. I'm an art critic. It's what I've been doing since I was 23 in Australia, in the UK, and now in the States. And that meant, you know, obviously going to exhibitions and writing about shows, but also, and increasingly, finding sort of interesting and more surprising ways to get at visual culture. And that could range from writing about politics, and of course that became increasingly important, but it also meant writing profiles and more personal essays, a whole range of things. It's such a rich field, and so I just felt so lucky to have the job and tried to make the most of it.
Was there a sense that the freedom of the arts was already closing in before Trump returned to office?
You know, I came to see the issues we were facing in culture as less a question of sort of left versus right than authoritarian impulses against sort of more liberal or you know, free impulses, which I think are the circumstances that art needs to thrive, an atmosphere of freedom. And I think those authoritarian impulses we're seeing very clearly and explicitly under Trump, I don't think that they're exclusively the preserve of the right. I think that on the left, we were seeing these sorts of impulses gain some power as well. And I think one of the sort of most notable examples of that, which really sort of came to a head around 2020 with COVID and then the Black Lives Matter movement after the horrible killing of George Floyd here, you had a sort of rising tendency towards a kind of censorship of speech. And in D.C., in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., you had an incident where a major exhibition of a really important artist called Philip Guston was cancelled or postponed, initially for 4 years. It ended up being less, but because they saw his work as a little too controversial at the time.
Yeah, what was controversial about Philip Guston? I mean, this is Biden is the president, Trump is off the scene, this is not a story about Trump. Yes. But here is a celebrated artist being given a retrospective in what, the most important public gallery in the United States. Why was he controversial?
Guston was a Jewish artist who'd campaigned against racism as a younger man and continued to feel that way politically. He was of the left and a very passionate and very moral man. He was, for a period, an abstract painter. But in the 70s, with the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War raging, he had a sort of change of heart. And one of, you know, a famous quote, he said, "What kind of a man am I going back into my studio every day, changing, you know, a red to a blue, you know, in these abstract paintings, when all this stuff is going on in the world outside, all these terrible things with the war and everything else?" And so he turned to a new kind of a new style of painting, which was figurative, and it was inspired by underground comics, but also by Italian Renaissance art. He used these sort of recurring figures in a lot of his paintings in the early 70s, which were these sort of idiotic kind of thugs who were running around town, and they had Ku Klux Klan type hoods. Did I say Ku Klux Klan? I meant Ku Klux Klan.
And you've got it right hoods, now.
These hoods were seen as just, you know, showing them in 2020 in the wake of George Floyd and all that was just seen as something that might upset a lot of people. And on those grounds, and really those grounds alone, they decided to cancel the show. And to me, this was really crazy, you know, and a lot of artists felt the same way. There were artists all over the States, including many African-American artists whom I interviewed about this. They signed petitions saying, you know, please don't postpone the show. He's incredibly important, this painter. He's a great artist, a very important artist. And if some of the imagery was going to be disturbing to some people, then yeah, the museum had a role to educate people, to warn them if that was seen as appropriate, just to fulfill its task of showing great art, but also educating people about that art. But instead, it chose to just give up on that role and cancel the whole thing. And I thought that was a really ominous sign of things to come.
And how many columns did you write about the cancelled Guston exhibition?
I mean, I ended up writing 4 or 5. And
good man.
I think I was just very concerned because it, you know, it really did have a chilling effect. I mean, an important museum like that postponing a show of this kind sends a message to all the other museums around America and even internationally saying, look, if you want to show art that might be a little bit controversial, you're going to get in trouble. And it might be better if you just put that off, at least for now. And that was, in fact, the language that was used, you know, by the National Gallery when it decided to cancel the show. It sort of said, we're postponing this until such time as we think the public will be able to handle it, you know? And I thought, wow, that is unbelievably patronizing, condescending, and yeah, so many other bad words. I couldn't abide it.
And has the show ever appeared?
Yeah, so the show was delayed. I guess it ended up being about 2 years, and then it opened not at the National Gallery, but at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. And so I reviewed it then, and you know, I love Guston. I think he's a tremendous artist, as I've indicated already. I don't think that they did a great job of presenting it, but at least they did end up presenting the show, and it did then tour the other venues.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am speaking to Sebastian Smee, Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic, formerly of The Washington Post. Sebastian, to that word, ugly word formerly. Now, when did you become aware that things were going wrong at the Post?
I joined, as I said, at a time when it was really thriving, not just in terms of readership, but it was profitable. You know, for, I think, 6 years at least, it was profitable. After Jeff Bezos bought it, he really sank some money into it. He really invested in new innovations and in trying to make the paper more national and international. It had sort of retreated just to being a kind of DC paper, very local in its concerns. But Bezos rightly recognized that it had a great brand and it could easily be pushed into a more national sort of readership and beyond that. And he was very successful at that. And he was helped by this great leadership of Marty Baron. He increased the newsroom by a lot and it was just doing really well. I mean, Marty understood that Bezos didn't like the idea of subsidizing an unprofitable company and felt quite rightly that there were ways to make it profitable. And he succeeded at doing that, you know, very quickly. At the same time, he was running a lot of other businesses, obviously Amazon, but also his space company. And, you know, that is what started to become a problem. A lot of his other companies had massive contracts with the federal government. And during Trump's first term, Trump used that fact to really bully the Washington Post and Bezos. And he was wanting more favorable coverage. He felt he wasn't getting it. And so he threatened Bezos with a lot of things, which really did cost him money. Contracts were canceled. But during that first term, Bezos really stood up to Trump. And Marty Baron, in the book that he wrote about this subsequently, was very open about that, saying that Bezos was a brave owner. He'd made a lot of good decisions and wasn't going to bend to this bullying by Trump and the administration.
But then Trump was coming back for a second time. And this time Bezos seemed not so brave. Was this lack of courage also associated with the fact that the paper was now losing a lot of money?
Yeah, your first point is exactly right. Something changed. Something really big changed, and Bezos completely changed his tune. You ask whether it had to do with the fact that the paper was losing money. The figures were pretty serious. I mean, over a few years, it lost several hundred million dollars. And that was attributed to various factors, changes in the media environment and in the way advertising worked and in the way social media got stories out there. You know, the algorithms were changed, all that kind of stuff. The sort of things that news organizations around the world have been struggling with.
Yeah.
But there was no reason to think that the Post wouldn't figure out a way to get back to profitability. And I think if Bezos had been more invested, he would have used his great business acumen to do that. But he wasn't interested. He became less and less engaged with the Post, more and more concerned with currying favor with the new Trump administration. And there's so much evidence for that. You know, I think you get to a point where what it looks like is kind of what it is. You know, I mean, you see Bezos refusing to, this was something that he did before the election, refusing to endorse a candidate for president, which is something that the Post had done for decades.
That made news around the world.
Exactly. And, you know, you can make the argument that a newspaper like the Post shouldn't make endorsements, but you don't make that decision just weeks out from the election. In a way that is going to be read by everyone as you sort of caving to power, seeing the writing on the wall that Trump is going to get elected, you decide not to endorse Kamala Harris, which is what the editorial board at the Post had decided it wanted to do.
Did that shock the journalists? Did that shock you, that move?
I think it shocked everyone, and most importantly, it shocked readers. And well, the Post lost hundreds of thousands of subscribers just in response to that decision alone. So that cut massively into the profits of the paper. And Bezos must have known that that was going to happen because people were so appalled, but he didn't care. He was willing to take that loss because what was more important to him was currying favor with the Trump government, presumably on behalf of all of his other businesses, the space business, the cloud computing that Amazon does, you know, massive contracts, the contracts with, you know, other arms of the government, including the military and I think, you know, Homeland Security and so forth. These things clearly started to matter to him much more than the independence and integrity of the Post.
Was he one of the billionaires at the inauguration?
So that's another thing we see. It looks bad. Is it that bad? Yeah, it is that bad. He gave $1 million to the inauguration, as did most of the other, you know, tech moguls. And he was there at the inauguration on display with the other leaders of Google, of Apple, and obviously Elon Musk was there. And that was a real show, you know. I mean, that really was just Trump's way to advertise, look, I have these people in my pocket and they're going to do as I say. And they seemed really unembarrassed about being put in that position, which I think we all found stunning.
Were you surprised then that staff cuts followed?
You know as well as I that it's often cultural coverage that's the first to go.
Yes.
In news organizations. You know, I love writing for a broad general readership publication. I felt proud not only at the Post but at the other newspapers I've worked for to be part of a bigger team. You know, I feel like, yeah, it just made me very proud to be part of a team that also was holding power to account, writing amazing breaking news stories coming out of the White House, but also fantastic stories about, you know, films and about travel tips and health, you know, wellness tips and that kind of stuff. I mean,
you weren't writing those yourself.
I wasn't writing them. No. But do you see what I mean? I felt good to be part of a bigger organization.
I know, and it is, incredibly exciting. Exciting.
It is always exciting to be part of something like that. And, you know, I could just be writing for the art world. I could be writing for art magazines and so forth. I was just glad not to be doing that, I suppose. But, yeah, it became very concerning when we heard about cuts coming. And I thought, yeah, I'll be vulnerable. But hopefully my experience and what I've done will keep me in the role. But then the news came down, it was announced over Zoom one morning. We were all told not to come into work and to join a Zoom meeting. And we were told that after the meeting, we'd open our emails. An email would be sent sort of 5 minutes after the meeting, and it would tell us if we still had a job or if our position had been eliminated. And so, yeah, that's how we all found out. There were more than 300 of us who found out that our jobs had been eliminated. And so that was sobering. I felt just, you know, obviously anxious for myself and my family, but in a way almost more upset for the Washington Post, for this great, great institution, this amazing, storied, you know, news organization, to be in this position now where it had seemingly a corrupted owner trying to curry favor with an authoritarian, a president with authoritarian impulses, willing to kind of sacrifice this amazing organization for his own interests. That's how it felt to me and still feels.
And do you see that as a bigger pattern in the United States? I mean, there's a long list now of attacks from Trump more directly on, you know, the Smithsonian, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Kennedy Center. Is this part of a Trumpian refashioning, particularly of the arts?
It's definitely hitting the arts, you know, and you notice it especially in D.C. Most museums around America, as you'll know, David, are sort of not run by the government. They sometimes get a little bit of funding from the government, but mostly not much, and it's more philanthropy that museums depend on. But in D.C., most of the museums there are funded by the government. And you mentioned the Smithsonian. That's a whole family of museums in DC. They're all government funded. So is the National Gallery. And the Kennedy Center as well, which is now been renamed the Trump Kennedy Center. These are all dependent on the government. And Trump has clearly decided that he wants to change not just politics, but culture. And so he's been firing people. He's been extorting museums, making them conform to this sort of jingoistic view of history.
Oh, we've never seen anything like that in Australia, have we, Sebastian?
fair point, but it's pretty flagrant here in ways that are really concerning. I think especially because they're part of a wider thing, you know, which is really much more concerning, and that is his attacks on the media, his extortion of universities and of law firms, the way he's using the power of the government to get vengeance, you know, on people who he perceives as his political enemies, and to intimidate. I mean, you saw just the other day he showed up at the Supreme Court to listen to hearings about the question of birthright citizenship. And no sitting president had done that in the longest time. I'm not sure. Yeah. I think it's
never
happened before.
I don't think maybe it's never
happened before. But, right.
And then wonderfully he stormed out when the
he wasn't happy with the way it was going.
No, he wasn't happy with the questions the judges were asking, so he stormed out. Sebastian, do you think it's fair to say that when you look at the attacks and the rhetoric around the attacks on various arts institutions in America, one of the things that comes up again and again and again is race? It's not just race at the Smithsonian, but at the National Endowment for the Arts, a swathe of grants were all just cancelled because of the allegation being that they were promoting extreme ideologies of race and gender, race and gender, race and gender all the time. Even allegations, which I'm delighted by, to learn that the Kennedy Center was somehow or other promoting radical leftist ideologies in ballet.
It's interesting. I mean, it's like they're using a critique that may in some cases have some value or some truth to it to just absolutely snuff out everything. It's really flagrant, it's really depressing, and it's unbelievably crude in the way it's being done. This is being backed by the full power and force of the federal government, and with all its, you know, all the money that it has to give out or not give out as the leverage. So it's frightening.
I wonder, Sebastian, whether the proof of what's going on is in Trump's insistence that United States government returns to classical architecture.
Yeah, it is a sign of a sort of reactionary moment. You've obviously seen the knocking down of the one of the wings at the White House, and it's going to be replaced by a big, very neoclassical ballroom. On top of that, of course, it's just this hideous sort of aesthetic that he has of just needing everything to be gilded. And presumably half of it's sort of made from plastic, but just got this, you know, gilded paint. But you know, every time we see footage of foreign leaders inside the White House, we're seeing more and more gilded decorations.
It's like a skin disease. It's spreading
that,
around
yes.
the Oval Office. Now, to be fair to Trump, he swears it's 24 carat. He doesn't say under it, but he swears it's 24 carat. But isn't the problem with this sort of insistence on classical architecture that classicism is the preferred style of the dictator? Certainly in the 20th century, there was a lot of classicism going on in Germany.
It's this idea of timelessness. I always find it very haunting to think about Albert Speer, the Nazi architect, who designed these very neoclassical kind of enormous buildings, but with a view to what they would look like as ruins. He wanted people to look back on the Third Reich as a sort of a glorious civilization, the same way that we look at the ruins of ancient Greece, you know, and get all wistful about that. He didn't obviously anticipate that these buildings would be ruined, you know, within years of them being built. But an unbelievable way to think, right? Just to think in those terms.
But what and a precedent. What a precedent for Washington. I mean, the ruin principle for the White House ballroom.
I know. It's crazy to think about. So, I mean, I think, David, it's a really sort of dizzying atmosphere. I think we're all feeling it in Australia and Europe, you know, everywhere. We're all sort of trying to get our heads around this crazy phenomenon that seems so multidimensional. It's happening in so many different fields. You know, we're talking about culture, but it's happening in the academy, in law, you know, throughout. Obviously, you know, questions of immigration and so forth are really immediate right now as well. And we're trying to make sense of it, and it's really difficult. But I think that's where journalism becomes incredibly important. And you know, to me, it's been interesting to think about journalists working in other situations, in Russia, for instance, and what they had to put up with for years and years and years. And I met one particular journalist, you know, whose husband or fiance was imprisoned by Putin for more than 20 years and who's now in the States herself, but he's still in prison. But she worked for the last remaining independent news organization in Moscow, until she had to flee just after the declaration of war against Ukraine, or the invasion of Ukraine. And just talking to people like that and getting a sense of, you know, the warning signs and what to look out for and so certain tendencies in a society before it heads that way. You know, every situation is distinct, but it is scary how many parallels there are.
Which is why we need you back in a job pretty soon, Sebastian Smee, and my hunch is that that's going to happen. Before we go, I have to ask you how the book is going, because we last spoke late 2024, I think, on your fabulous book, Paris in Ruins, Love, War and the Birth of Impressionism. It's been praised everywhere. I hope it's sold a mozza.
Thank you, David. It was so great to talk about that. And your own book, Killing Country, is just magnificent.
Oh, shut up.
I know that's been selling well as well.
All going to be cut. I'm just asking you politely whether it's gone well, because I reckon it should have, okay?
Well, thank you. I think it's gone well. And I've got a new one that I'm about to sign a contract for, so we'll see how that goes.
And we shall talk to you about it on the show.
That would be great, David. Always. I'd love that. That's so kind of you.
Fair enough. You're locked in. I have been talking to Sebastian Smee, who until recently has been working with the Washington Post, is sure to be popping up somewhere else very, very soon, about the situation in America for newspapers, the arts, and taste in Trump's America. This is Late Night Live. Up next, Daniel Defoe, novelist and spy. I'm not sure I read Robinson Crusoe when I was a kid, maybe the classic comic, but I seem to have absorbed it over time, as we all do, and I can't say I've ever really been curious about its author, Daniel Defoe, just a man in a long wig who wrote a classic in 1719. But along comes Mark Marofsky, writing not about the making of that famous novel, but about Daniel Defoe's role a decade earlier as a spy in Scotland. Defoe was employed to report on those in Scotland opposing the union with England in the early 18th century, the creation of the United Kingdom. Mark is South African-born, Sydney-educated, had an academic career in England and Scotland, is now a lecturer in English at Melbourne University, and his book is A Spy Amongst Us, Daniel Defoe's Secret Service and the Plot to End Scottish Independence. Mark joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mark, you're not surprised by spies turning into novelists and vice versa. You see a crossover. What is it?
I think the basic motivation of both groups is quite similar. To embrace a cover story, to fully inhabit the life of somebody else, to read people for their motives, for their flaws, for the sort of wants and needs of character. To me, there's a massive crossover between novelists and spies. And I think for that reason, there's so many novelists and spies, so many spies who later became novelists and vice versa. I'm thinking Defoe primarily because I've spent the last 7 years with him and even more, but also Aphra Behn, Graham Greene, Peter Matheson, John le Carré. There's just so many where you see a crossover between what they do as both spies and as novelists.
Is there another thing about spying? Is that it's something you do after you've failed spectacularly at something else?
I mean, that was certainly the case for Defoe. And I don't know, but is that the same for novelists? Do you write the novel when all else is...
No. But spying is actually doing it in real life, impersonating, eavesdropping, reporting on people. That is taking invention a few more steps. And it seems to me that it's correlated with failure in other fields. I mean, Defoe was a fabulous failure, wasn't he?
He has to be one of history's worst business people.
That's a high bar.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's unfair, but for somebody who is, I think the gulf between him as an economic thinker and writer and his practice as a business person is just so vast. He wrote all these interesting economic tracts. He's a key thinker of the sort of projecting age of the 18th century, and yet not a single one of his business ventures worked. It's why, as you said, he turned to spying and why he latterly turned to writing these more extended prose fictions.
Tell us about his businesses.
The ones that stick out to me, I mean, he'd been a hosier, but he'd also tried to import civet cats because their glands were used for perfume making in the 18th century. But, you know, could have been predicted that civet cats don't actually... live particularly well in London's climate, so they all died. He also had a brick and tile factory that went out of business. I think it was about 2 weeks before the Great Storm of London hit in 1704, a time when I assume people would have needed new roof tiles and bricks. It's just a series of squandered money after squandered money, all these great ideas that never really came to much financially for him.
But he got into trouble, didn't he, because he was a pamphlet writer.
Yeah, in 1702, he pushed it perhaps a little too far, and he wrote this pamphlet called The Shortest Way with the Dissenters. So Defoe was a Presbyterian, which in England put him in the religious minority. He was outside the Anglican communion, and because of that he had certain civil disabilities. He couldn't go to university, for instance. He couldn't hold public office. So he wrote this pamphlet responding to a high church, a backlash against the dissenters that came about with the accession of Queen Anne. And he assumes the voice, again, imitation, he assumes the voice of a high church preacher. And he basically advocates extirpating dissenters from England. It's a sort of ethnic cleansing. When it's revealed that he was the author, a dissenter, all hell breaks loose. The hoax is exposed, and those who are sort of drawn to the logical endpoints of their prejudice are absolutely exposed for what that prejudice represents to the polity. So he is charged with seditious libel and goes on the run, essentially trying to avoid Newgate prison.
Which he fails to do.
Yes.
You have a wonderful description of him. What did he look like?
So the first description we get of Defoe is when he's on the run, avoiding the Duke of Nottingham, who was the Secretary of State at the time's men. And Nottingham puts an ad in the London Gazette, and it describes Defoe as, "He is a middle-sized spare man, about 40 years old, of a brown complexion and dark brown-coloured hair, but wears a wig, a hook nose, a sharp chin, grey eyes, and a large mole near his mouth. Was born in London and for many years was a hose factor in Freeman's Yard in Cornhill and is now the owner of the Brick and Pantile Works near Tilbury Fort in Essex."
Now, what does that description tell you about the man beyond the physical?
There's a deep class bias in this description, I think. He's a thoroughly average merchant here. He's a former hosier, that's what a hose factor is. Now he's the producer of bricks and roof tiles. But he has a pointed chin, a hook-nosed, grey eyes, and they give a sort of form to the man who is struggling to hide what I think is his rat-sharp nature beneath an all-too-affected dress. There is a bit of pathos in this attempt. Maybe that's just my own bias, but the description of the wig, to point out that somebody is wearing a wig, is to point out that their wig is out of fashion. So Defoe, as you said in your introduction, wore a really long wig. The fashion at the stage was for a much shorter one. Defoe's wig was the kind from the last century sort of court. It was the sort of the Charles II court type long wig. It was probably going to drop into somebody's coffee at a coffee house where Defoe spent a lot of his time. And he was kind of foppish in that way. He was depicted elsewhere wearing a pinky ring. And it's a sort of, it's an image of a man who's both not of the right class, but sticking his hook nose into the business of that class. He's a sort of, what is this merchant doing sticking his nose into affairs of state, is the image I get, is the sort of picture I get from this image.
Being a Presbyterian was the key to his rescue from prison, wasn't it?
In many ways. So he was eventually caught and thrown in prison, faced a bench of judges, one of whom he'd satirised terribly in a previous pamphlet. So, you know, a lot of bad luck and maybe uncontrolled pen in some ways. And so he ends up in Newgate Prison, which he, in Moll Flanders, calls an emblem of hell itself. It was an absolutely horrific place. And while he's there, he appeals to whomever he feels might be able to, you know, help him, either pay his sureties that would allow his release or in some ways get him a pardon. And he writes to William Paterson. And Paterson was a fellow Presbyterian. He was the man who sort of helped come up with the idea for the Bank of England. He's best known today as the founder of the disastrous Darien scheme, Scotland's attempt to colonise the Isthmus of Panama. But through Paterson, he appeals to Robert Harley, who was then Speaker of the House of Commons, but a real up-and-coming politician and would soon be very key to England's Anglo-Scottish relations. And he offers his services to Harley as a propagandist. And you're very right. I mean, If not then, at least later, Defoe's Presbyterianism became key, because after sending him on a couple of missions around England, building up an intelligence network, building up a series of informers and distribution agents, Harley sends Defoe to Scotland. And Scotland, dominant religion is Presbyterianism. Defoe can move with a fluency that an Anglican could not. And so he's a key agent in the end in Scotland.
Mark, remind me, I must have known at some point, but remind me, Scotland and England had had a common monarch since James I. Why now was there this notion that the two kingdoms should actually merge into one country with one parliament?
It's a bit of a complex one, but I think it's a combination of dynastic and geopolitical issues. The Scottish Parliament had retained its independence despite the common monarch, and they were quite offended by the fact that the English Parliament had passed the Act of Succession, which would allow the heirs of the Electress of Hanover, who become the Georgians, George I, and so on, to assume the throne of England without consulting the Scottish Parliament. So the Scottish Parliament starts to do things to reassert Scotland's sovereignty. They pass a couple of acts that would allow them to choose their own successor to Anne, and also to determine their own foreign policy, to choose when and where and how they go to war. So this poses a big problem for England, because Scotland is a weak point. There's a major fear that there'll be a French invasion with the Scottish Jacobites that will come from the north and then down to England. And that would also draw troops away from the European conflict and leave England in a... England had been fighting an extended war with France and its allies in Europe, the War of the Spanish Succession, and they don't want to lose troops, nor do they want to be invaded. And so for these two reasons, England wants greater control over Scotland and its politics. Defoe basically says it's going to be civil war or union, one of these two options. And he repeats this phrase fairly often throughout his time there. Sometimes melodramatically, oftentimes I think it's quite accurate that unless England found a way to better solve the dynastic issues, there were also issues of the Scottish Parliament paying for the civil lists in Scotland to keep the government running, to keep everything running. So there's a lot of internecine issues as well as broader geopolitical ones that sort of force the need for a greater union, a political union, as well as a dynastic monarchical one.
Mark, who were the opponents of union that Daniel Defoe was sold onto?
I think I'm going to have to do the high school history essay. They were many and varied, but never united, I think, is the key point. So there were people in England who opposed it. My focus in the book, because it's what Defoe's working on, are the opponents in Scotland. We have the Jacobites, those who had been ousted by the Hanoverian succession. So, you know, from James II, who had been deposed in 1685, replaced by William of Orange and his wife Mary. And from that point on, there's a sort of rival claim to the English and British throne.
Yep.
So the Jacobites were a key opponents of the Union because they wanted the Union they saw as cementing the Hanoverian succession. They wanted the return of the rightful king. There's a key connection between Jacobites and the Highland clans who often, you know, saw the Stuarts as their apotheosis, their guardians. There's also radical Presbyterians who don't want a union with an English parliament where bishops sit. That's an absolute anathema to them. And then there's also some Episcopalians who resist the union for what it might do for their sort of support of alternate claimants to the throne. So there's a couple of key groups, but they make up quite a big proportion of Scotland. And the treaty itself, once it was published in Edinburgh, is deeply unpopular on the streets as well. So there's a popular movement against it that Defoe confronted when he arrived in Scotland in September 1706.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Mark Mirofsky about his book on the role of Daniel Defoe in sabotaging those forces in Scotland who wished to resist the Union. Now, Mark, what did he do? How did he operate? Who did he report to?
So it was a much looser ring of spies than we might assume based on modern intelligence practices. But he reports to Robert Harley back in London. Harley, by this stage, is now Secretary of State for the Northern Department, which includes Scotland. And Harley, unbeknownst to Defoe, is running quite a lot of spies in Scotland. Some Defoe knows about, most he doesn't. So Harley's getting quite a comprehensive picture of what's happening in the Scottish Parliament, in the various subcommittees that are dealing with how the Union will be affected and put in place, and also the wider man-on-the-street type problems, the sort of popular uprisings. So Defoe, while he's there, he visits Parliament every day. He also manages to inveigle himself into the General Commission of the Kirk, so those ministers who were deeply influential in Scotland. And what he does is try to prevent them from nationalising. If the Kirk can be dispersed and their opposition to union be based on a presbytery-to-presbytery level, they'll never have the kind of cohesive national force that might present a massive problem. And Defoe, I think, is key in splitting that up. He also manages, for all his failed businesses, to get himself employed as a sort of ad hoc press officer to the committee that's calculating the equivalent. So the equivalent was this once-off payment that was meant to compensate for Darien and the losses there, but also to offset the greater tax burden that Scotland would assume when they became part of the Union. And because of that, he has quite an important role negotiating, but also popularising post-Union economic policies. And he runs agents as well. Defoe runs key agents that manage to infiltrate the radical Presbyterian Covenanters of the Southwest and prevent them from joining up with the Highlanders. The worry in England and in the pro-Union Scots was that these two disparate but very powerful groups would join together despite their massive political differences and form a concerted block of opposition to the Union. So one of Defoe's agents, I think, is quite key in preventing that from happening.
Is it your argument that what Defoe was doing here was innovatory, that he was actually working out systems that would survive him and become, in time, sort of basic organisational rules for spies?
I think so. And if not for spies, for the extension of domestic surveillance and for the role that will be occupied in later years and up to this day by the paid political operative. I think Defoe's work crosses that line. He is gathering intelligence, but he's deploying it to very particular political ends, using it to better know and shape the people, better know and shape what's happening on the street, to sort of tamp down popular resistance, but also to influence key players in parliament and in the committees. So, yes, it's surveillance, and it's a key milestone in the history of spycraft, I think, but also in the advent of a new kind of figure whose role in politics is going to become deeply, deeply influential, this operative who exists between the people and the principles.
But there was this other life as well. So while he's ingratiating himself with these groups, he's also writing pamphlets, I presume anonymously, that had they known about, they would never have let him through their door.
Yeah, absolutely. The title from the book comes from John Clark of Penicuik, who says, had we known, the mob in Edinburgh would have torn Defoe to pieces. Had we known he was a spy amongst us, the mob would have torn him to pieces. So he is an unbelievably productive writer, which becomes a massive problem for those of us who try to get a handle on him, to either teach his works or to write about them.
Don't complain. You've been at this perfectly happily for a number of years. Go on.
Just the better part of a decade. But yes, so he's very productive. But you're right, he is writing anonymously. Not only is he writing anonymously, he's often writing from a number of different viewpoints, and it becomes a sort of orchestrated heteroglossia. If he can write from the sort of the radical Presbyterian position, but he can also write from the moderate position, he can also write from all these other positions and draw the reader in the alehouse to the same basic principle. And coincidentally, that same basic principle is the sort of Queensbury Harley line for union, usually.
What did he achieve?
That's a really difficult one. I think it's very hard to make the direct case that the union wouldn't have happened without his presence. But I think what we can do, and what I've tried to do in the book, is to say he is vital in keeping it on track. He is vital in keeping the popular opposition at bay. He is vital in helping Queensbury, Harley, and the other principals in persuading the right people to keep the voting bloc united enough to pass the treaty. But I think one of the more significant things that he did and achieved was that he wrote the first History of the Union. And this began as a cover story. When his cover story that he'd fled England and he wanted to establish businesses in Scotland was sort of losing a bit of currency, people were starting to suspect, he began to tout the idea that, you know, he is there to write the first history of Scotland and the Union. And because of this cover story, he gets access to parliamentary minute books, he gets access to secret intelligence that he then passes on. But he then, cover story becomes fact, and he writes the history in 1709. And from that, I mean, historians still use it today, that it is the first comprehensive account of what happens in the parliament and outside of it to bring Scotland and England together. And that's a massive win. It sort of sets, in many ways, the historiographic tone for the union and how it's appreciated ever since. So, in short, I think really his achievements are twofold. In the moment, he was there on the ground making sure the Union Treaty passed the Scottish Parliament. But perhaps more significantly, he was ensuring that the Union was represented and understood in a certain way that may allow for its continuation. If it's received in a certain light, it might take hold in the hearts and minds of those in England and Scotland and keep it together.
Do you see traces of this experience in the fiction that he later wrote? I mean, is there some sort of sense in Robinson Crusoe that he knows this kind of world?
Yeah, I think so. The fiction he wrote very much at the end of his life, between 1719 and 1724. And there is a continuation. There's this sort of spy and novelist parallel. There's also the fact that in Colonel Jack, he's writing about Scottish Jacobites in a way that suggests he has key understanding of them. But perhaps on a deeper level, a lot of his narrators are involved in some kind of extended deception. I'm thinking of Moll Flanders, I'm thinking of Roxana, more than Crusoe. But with Crusoe, which is perhaps, I mean, not perhaps, it is the novel for which he's remembered, that sense of isolation, that sense of resourcefulness, of doing it yourself, that uneasy relation between the individual and society, that really resonates with what he did as a spy, where he was left to his own devices and had to cobble his work and be really quite resourceful in how he supported himself and made his way in a very difficult, hostile place.
I sort of see a parallel between life on a desert island and the deceptive life of the eavesdropper spy. There's something about being so alone in both roles.
Yeah, I mean, because Defoe is a man who thrived on sociability. He is a denizen of the 18th century coffee house, talking politics, arguing, writing. And yes, he was doing that in Edinburgh, but as you said, it's this double consciousness. He couldn't quite have the same kind of connection in Edinburgh that he'd had in London because of this fact that he had, you know, a secret master. So, yeah, I think there must be some kind of parallel, really, between the true sort of unsociable isolation of the spy and the man condemned, yeah, to a life alone until Friday comes along.
Mark, as a Presbyterian, this man was sort of a bit ashamed of writing fiction. I love this notion that he published two great novels anonymously.
Yes, and some of that has to do with the deep suspicion that fiction attracted in his period. It was seen as a lie, as a dissimulation. And for Defoe, the very pious Presbyterian, this causes a bit of a moral conflict. Maybe it's a bit more than a bit of a moral conflict. It causes quite a dilemma. And he tries in his letters to Harley to justify the kind of work he does, writing as a spy, to make sure that Harley, if not Harley, at least posterity will see that he always kept true to his principles and that when lies were deployed, it was for a specific moral goal. And I think if we look at the editorial openings to his novels, he tries to do the same. When he's representing vice, as he does in Moll Flanders and Roxana, The Fortunate Mistress, it's for a moral purpose. So there's a real worry about lying and dissimulation is the word Defoe would have used. But he tries to think his way out of it. I'm not sure if he ever successfully does, but yet he still produces these masterful works of fiction. But he presents them as fact. This is the surprising life. It's a biography. This is the true history. It's a history. It's not, he never says this is, you know, and that's because the novel is so young in England, but also because of the moral judgment that attaches to lying and to fiction as a subset of lying.
Do you think it's time for me to read Robinson Crusoe?
It's not my favourite of Defoe's novels, and I shouldn't say that because I'm hoping to work on Crusoe next. But yeah, I think so. It's always worth
so what should I read?
My favourite is The Fortunate Mistress, which we used to know as Roxana. It's the most psychologically interesting and deep, and the character has a lot more self-reflection than some of the others in Defoe's canon.
I've got all the time in the world. I'll dip into it tonight.
It's only about 400 pages. You should be totally fine.
And you can get it online, I presume, at a very reasonable cost.
Yeah, of course.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
I've been
talking to Mark Mirofsky about his new book, the work of many, many years, studying the life of Daniel Defoe. It is called A Spy Amongst Us, Daniel Defoe's Secret Service and the Plot to End Scottish Independence. Mark, that battle is still going on, isn't it?
Absolutely.
For further discussion, this is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, A.D. Hope, the poet who haunts Australian writing, whose great lines we still remember all these years later from school and university. Now What Hope Feared in Life Has Happened, 26 years after his death, a biography, the first of a complex and contradictory man with much to hide who shaped Australian writing. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.